boys and girls, wherever you are around the world, and thank you for joining us once again on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letteru.org. It is time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
G'day to you too.
We're in 1 Samuel chapter 20, and this is not a short chapter, right?
No, not short at all. This is a pretty long one, though there aren't too many stories in this one. It revolves around a pretty simple subject, but it goes back and forth a lot. The discussions between the characters, it's just very verbal. There's a lot of wording in between the characters, mm-hmm. When they say something, a response back and forth, like a ping pong. But it all really revolves around one character, which is Jonathan. So he's really the main character of this piece, where he's trying to be the peacemaker. He's trying to function like a UN, unsuccessfully function like a UN in between David and Saul, trying to see if there's a way of getting them back together without really a fight. Mm-hmm. And he's very hopeful because he loves his father, and there's a tension between he and his father, and he also loves David, and he wants to have both of them together. He wants them to have a friendship between one another, which is something that I personally experienced a lot while living here, specifically where I live now. That you have people, because it's a small place, you have people that don't really agree with one another, but you're trying to be friends with everyone. Mm. And sometimes you're trying to find a way of having them together in the same room without them fighting. So it's quite common, in small places. And so if anyone's ever lived in a small place, they probably know what Jonathan's really going through, where he wants to be friends with everyone. He likes everyone, but there's certain people who don't really like each other.
And so he finds his loyalty split, right?
Exactly. And then you have to hula hoop and dance around trying to appease it, to be friendly with everyone, appease everyone without turning on anyone's feelings. And that can be very tiresome, and it's very difficult sometimes to do. And if anyone's lived in a small place, they probably know what I mean. So Jonathan's really the main character here. He talks a lot and goes back and forth here with David for a while, with Saul. There's also a lot of oath taking here. Jonathan recognizes something at one point. He kind of realizes that probably David's going to be the next king, mm-hmm. and Saul already says that very clearly as well. Saul knew, he already knew that someone's going to replace him, and probably Jonathan and everyone else knew this, mm-hmm. but now they're starting to really realize, they're starting to recognize that David's really the one that's going to replace them, and Jonathan is accepting of that. On the other hand, Saul is trying to fight against it. It means Saul continues the kind of rebellious understanding that he was in to begin with, which is what really caused him to lose the kingship.
Is there reason to believe, Yoel, that Samuel hasn't mentioned the anointing of David to others? I mean, would he have kept that entirely secret? Is there perhaps rumors that might have traveled to Jonathan?
It might be, but the text doesn't tell us any mm-hmm. of that. They kept it kind of secret, but again, you never know, because it was done probably in front of the family, and we know that there's a tension between David and his brother, his older brother at least. Sure. It might be that his brother said something, so you never know.
You never know. It's possible, but you're right. There is a lot of dialogue. That is the theme of this particular chapter, and it's not without its controversy. So we're gonna get into that.
And also another thing is the Hebrew text itself in this chapter, there are a lot of problems with it textually. There are words missing, sentences that don't really make sense part of the time. You kind of have to complete them. So this is actually considered to be one of the more disrupted versions of this chapter. Really? That actually got into the Masoretic text. But the Septuagint, for example, is considered to be a bit better than the one we have here. Mm-hmm. It could be, but again, we have to remember something very simple. The Septuagint is a translation, which means someone read it in Hebrew and went, this sentence doesn't make sense, and they rewrote it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that what we have here is not original. It could be that this is the original, or that this is partially is dependent on, it does come from the original. I mean, the original might have been something different. There were some mistakes along the line, but saying that, for example, translating like the Septuagint would be more correct only means that it can mean one or two things. One would be either it is a better version, but it can also mean that someone sat down and corrected some of the sentences because mm-hmm. they realized something was wrong.
Potentially. So I'm glad you said that too, by the way. I was thinking about that earlier in the week. When I did Greek, when I studied Greek, my Greek teacher at the very beginning of the class said to all of us, he said, any translation, you have to remember this, any translation is a traitor. You cannot accurately, 100% accurately convey what is said in one language into another language.
But also, any translation is also a commentary, which means someone could put something into it to comment on what they think it should mean.
Mm-hmm.
So, as the classic example we brought up a couple of times with the issue of the chatnez, the mixing of wool and linen, where mm-hmm. the Greek translations say such as wool and linen, where the Hebrew doesn't say anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just as an example. So again, it's not only that they can't really always convey what exactly is said in the original language. Also, the other problem is that sometimes it's also a commentary, so it changes what the original text says.
Sure, very good. So this is how it begins. 1 Samuel chapter 20. Then David fled from Naioth in Ramah, and went and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity, and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" Now, with that, I suppose Yoel, maybe it's news to Jonathan that that Shaul threw another spear at David and it got lodged in the wall. Maybe Jonathan doesn't know about that, because Jonathan says to him, "By no means, you shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, either great nor small, without telling me first. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so."
Well, it could be that Jonathan is basically trying to be the peacemaker again. He's saying, no, he didn't mean to hurt you. It was by mistake or something. He could be that he's a certain level of denial here, and he doesn't want to admit to the fact that his father is actually really trying to kill David.
Perhaps.
That's a possibility as well. Or what you just said, that it's possible as well that he didn't know that this happened. But he's dealing with a general idea. He's not referring to the specific case where he threw a spear at him. He's talking in general that, you know, he's no interest of killing you. Maybe he's thinking, maybe he was trying to hurt you because you did something, but he has no intention of killing you.
Potentially, that might be what he's saying. And so, and here, as you mentioned, there's a lot of oath taking here. There's a lot of invoking of the name of God in this passage. And it goes on to say in verse 3, David took an oath again and said, "Your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this lest he be grieved. But truly, as Yehovah lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death."
The issue of taking oaths. One of the ways of telling someone, you know, "I swear it's true" or something, it's very common here in the Middle East. And when we were children and we didn't know better, we used to oath about something being true or false all the time, mm-hmm. literally all the time. And it's part of how things were done in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
You oath all the time because, you know, if you don't believe me, I'll take an oath. So some people just automatically say an oath. And also what's very interesting here is that he says here, "Chai Adonai v'chein nafshecha." So it's very common that the name, that when it refers to God, it's always Chai. But when it refers to a person, it's Che, and there's a switch there, and it's very, very common. It's very, very common that when it always refers to God, it's Chai, and when it refers to a human being, it's Che. Now, Nafshecha, it's not your soul. Che Nafshecha is as you live, not the life of your soul or something, as you live.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when someone says Che Roshi, it was very common in Talmudic times to say Che Roshi, as my head exists. You know, basically taking an oath is something that's eternal, something which is understood to be real and something that continues forever. Mm-hmm. So so it can also bear witness forever. So taking an oath in the name of God and also taking an oath by one's spirit, which is considered to be the eternal part of the human being, was a very, very common thing to do.
Sure. So Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you." And David said to Jonathan, "Indeed, tomorrow is the new moon." Now here's a controversial verse. We'll get to this in just a second. But he says, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king to eat. But let me go, that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked permission of me that I might run over to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family If he says, thus it is well, your servant will be safe. But if he's very angry, be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore, you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of Yehovah with you. Nevertheless, if there is iniquity in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? Now, let's go back to the beginning of that passage.
So, first of all, he says, Hine chodesh machal. So, first of all, the word chodesh. Chodesh basically means a new moon. The word chodesh was also synonymous with the word moon itself. Mm-hmm. And he turns around and says, tomorrow is a new moon. Now, the word machal as well usually means tomorrow, mean the morrow, meaning the daytime, which we can learn several things from this. First of all, we learn that celebrating things, which is usually done during the day, meaning that you know, the new moon, maybe even most of the feast, maybe even the Sabbath, was the main event was during the day. Mm-hmm. Is the Sabbath a 24-hour thing or 12-hour thing? Is a very good question. But we have to remember that work wasn't really done during nighttime. When we have to define work is a whole discussion by itself. But even if we say if work is really what you do out in the field and with your cattle and, you know, you're sewing, you're knitting, whatever it might be, you know, the stuff you do in your workshop, whatever this stuff might be, people initially didn't do it during the night because it was very wasteful to burn oil and wood to have light. So you start early in the morning and you work all the way to night to when it goes dark and then you go home. So first of all, he says to him, tomorrow means tomorrow morning. Tomorrow from sunrise is a new moon. So some people use these verses, this, because this repeats at least twice in this chapter. Mm-hmm. They try to say, well, you know, tomorrow is a new moon. They somehow conclude that based on this, it's the conjunction which is the new moon, which I really don't understand how you can say that. But because for a very, very simple reason, they could be standing there outside towards sunset or at nighttime. Remember, they're meeting in secret. So they can be standing there somewhere towards nighttime, and they can be even seeing the new moon outside. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no actual proof that we're dealing with conjunction, because it's quite possible that they're seeing the new moon as we speak. And he says, well, tomorrow we're celebrating the new moon, so here's an idea.
Oh, so okay, if I understand you correctly, Yoel, it's potentially they're outside at twilight, the sun is set, they're chatting away in the twilight of the evening, and they see potentially the first slither of the moon. Therefore, the next day they're celebrating the new moon. So he's saying tomorrow is the new moon. Is that potentially one reading of this?
That's potentially one reading of it. And also dealing with the issue of calculating. The sighting of the new moon, you have to remember something. Sighting the new moon wasn't something that was really held in ceremony in the second temple, in the first temple period, or even before that. Meaning, they didn't have that elaborate system that's described in the second temple period. What they had was you go out, you see the new moon, that's basically it. Mm-hmm. If we're dealing with, for example, calculation, one of the major arguments that went on in medieval times was in between Rav Saadia Gaon, who was one of the Geonites of Babylon, with Ben Meir, who was a Geonite of the land of Israel, and they disputed over what they referred to as an old conjunction, which means that there was a certain amount of time from the sunset to when there was when the moon would show. It's a pretty complex mathematical thing. But they argue between them back and forth. And at one point, Ben Meir says something to Rav Saadia, and he says, well, if we do this, he gives a calculation. And he says, and Rav Saadia says to Ben Meir, well, that would be nice if we're doing things based on sighting. And Ben Meir writes back to him and says, what do you mean? We cite the new moon. We've been doing this for thousands of years. What are you talking about? The point was that Rav Saadia Gaon was a big advocate of the idea of calculating. He believed the calculation existed from day one, and there always was a calculation, which was a very typical thing with Rav Saadia Gaon, that he would take any customs they had at the time and try to prove that they were truthful and they're real and they've always been existence from the time of Moses, which is a very, very typical thing with his method. He does that all the time. Mm-hmm. So basically using a calculation, again, calculation is something which would be in the hands of people who know mathematics, who understand astronomy and things like that. But if you have the regular farmer who just lives on his farm, the only two ways for him to conclude when a new month is will be either by sighting a new moon or by the next night realizing there's no moon outside. Mm-hmm. Now, The problem here specifically is with the word Chodesh itself. The word Chodesh is synonymous with the word moon, which means how can you call something moon if there's nothing out there?
Well, but clearly there is something there. I mean,
you don't see anything. And the other side of it as well, we have to remember, there are a lot of similarities in between the northern Mesopotamian calendars and the calendar mentioned in the Bible. Mm-hmm. All these discussions, for example, like how do you decide when the month of Aviv is based on? You know, do you add days to each month, or do you add a month every once in a while to develop the calculation? The thing is that, for example, adding a month makes more sense with the system of the Bible, where it's lunar solar, because you have to fit the time of the moon with the appearance or disappearance of the moon, which means you either have 29 or 30 days. Mm-hmm. But by adding a day, for example, making 31 days every once in a while, that doesn't work when you use a cycle of the moon, which is, by the way, the adding a day to months to different months is an Egyptian system. The problem here specifically is that it's a chodesh, which means it fits inside the cycle of the moon. And the adjustment is every once in a while to the cycle of the sun. So it's very difficult to say that you add days. It's more reasonable to say you add months. By doing that, you kind of basically realize that the calendar mentioned in the Bible is a calendar which actually fits more the Mesopotamian calendar, Babylonian or Assyrian, which also might also fit what we have in the description, you know, when God turns around to Moses, says, "Hachodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodeshim ulechodshei hashana." You know, basically, God turned around to Moses and saying, "This is the first month, which will be the first month for your years." Very bad quotation in English, but anyhow,
Exodus chapter 12.
Exactly. So there's a possibility that God is turning around to Moses and saying, well, up to the past 200 years, you've been using the Egyptian calendar. We're going back to something else. And he's basically introducing the northern calendar, which is what's practiced until this very day by Jews, Karaite and Rabbinic.
Mm. So I've also heard the argument there are some that say for them to be able to look up and see that tomorrow, for them to be able to accurately predict that the next day is going to be the new moon, there are some who say, well, it must have been the last slither, the last crescent, if you like, before the moon, and therefore the dark moon is what's called the new moon.
Well, first of all, two things. First of all, that's an Egyptian calendar. It's an Egyptian system. Mm-hmm. The waxing moon. But on the other hand, we have to remember, he's saying tomorrow morning is the new moon. So if we're basing it on dark moon, it has to be 2 days from then.
No, it doesn't actually, because the dark moon is sighted in the morning before the sun comes up.
No, you can't start a dark moon.
You can sight. I'm telling you, the dark moon is sighted in the morning before the sun comes up.
I know what you're saying, but the problem here specifically is if he's saying tomorrow is a new moon, okay, then if they're seeing the dark moon vanishing at sunrise, then he can't say tomorrow. He has to say later on, sometime in the week. Okay, there's a technical problem here where they're standing. I mean, again, it's possible that they're standing there outside towards sunrise, and they're having a discussion, and he's telling him that it's tomorrow, meaning the next day, the time of day, and then night, and then day. But I have to ask a very, very simple question to all these different methods. Mm. If there's a system that's agreed upon, and it's been agreed upon for a very, very long time, and you go into the Second Temple period, and it's well attested this is what they did, and everyone did it this way, why do people insist on looking for other systems? Why do people start traveling towards, again, people are going to say, well, what about the Essenes? What about the calendar found in Qumran? The calendar found in Qumran completely and utterly ignores the idea of a moon cycle. It doesn't care about the moon cycle. It has a calendar that, by the way, based on calculations, if they were carried on a couple hundred years, they'll end up having Passover in wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was a very theoretical calendar. And again, this is a sectarian group. But I have a very simple question. Yes, all these opinions, you can argue them into the text. The same way I've seen people make arguments for the lunar Sabbath or anything like that. And again, you know what? If you want to do something different, I'm not gonna be the one judging anyone. You know, you decide that this is how you interpret the verses is perfectly fine. I'm not really bothered by that. But I'm saying there's a very, very simple question. Jews, no matter where they were, okay, and you have to put aside your pride and your ego and everything, okay. Mm-hmm. Jews as Jews have been practicing the Torah from the day it was given. Okay, there were no real massive disputes if it's based on conjunction, or do you cite the new moon or stuff like that. I know people are looking, trying to find in scrolls and stuff like that, and places like that, they're trying to prove that, you know, it might have been something else or some other group that did something else, but there's no real evidence except for the sectarian scroll, that the calendar scroll was discovered in Qumran. And we don't even know if this was something was done by any specific group. The fact that I find a book, it reminds me of there's a scholar here in Israel. She keeps on claiming that the true story is what we find in the scrolls. You know, I can write a story about what's going on here in Israel now and write it from my perspective. And then 1,000 years down the road, someone will discover and say, this is the true history of what happened. And I can bluff through my teeth to tell this story. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying something very, very simple. Again, yeah, you can accommodate some of these opinions. It's quite possible. I'm not going to argue about that possibility. I'm saying that something a bit more simpler than that. This is something which is pretty agreed upon in the Second Temple. And after that, and you know, I dare use the word tradition, it was passed down and it was understood as being as such. The Bible, and scholars agree on this, the Bible doesn't really give us much in the field of how to use a calendar. Mm. It assumes that, again, there are a lot of people like, oh, we don't believe in oral law, we don't believe in oral law. But again, you know, it's not always that simple. You know, you can say you're against something, but on the other hand, how do you answer certain questions? Now, there are places where someone would argue, you know, we don't have a clear indication how to do something, and then you do discover it. Mm. But on the other hand, when it comes to the calendar, this is agreed across the board by scholars, the Bible doesn't tell us much about how the calendar was used. Mm. And then, for example, when does the day begin? The Bible doesn't really 100% tell us. You have places where it sounds as if it starts at sunrise. You have places where it says it starts at sunset. So one of the possibilities that was brought up was that throughout the history, customs changed here and there and everywhere, where at some point they did this way, and some point they did that way, and then someone did that way because we're dealing with texts, and each person came up with a different idea. And maybe even the First Temple period, this confusion already existed. But when you look in the Second Temple period and basically anywhere after that, you clearly see that they based it on citing a new moon. It was a very, very specific cycle. And yes, you can argue that this was a Babylonian influence. You can argue, you can say that as well. I'm not going to argue with that possibility as well. Oh. And this is why I say, you know, when it comes to calendar issues, I really don't try not to put my head into it, because there are different opinions, and many of them are possible, and many of them are valid. Mm. And what exactly they did.
Can I just emphasize what you just said? Many of them are possible and many of them are valid. They're plausible and they're valid. And why are they plausible and valid? Because they're at least, though they may differ, all somebody wants to see is an argument based on the text.
Exactly.
And a fair one at that. And you know, not just one text, not just one verse, but please, let's put an argument together based on the text. And that's what we want to see.
Exactly. So going back to this specific verse, it's possible they were standing there when the sun was rising and the moon was setting and they knew exactly when it's going to be. It's possible they were standing there when the sun was setting and they could see the new moon. It could be that they were using some kind of a calculation, that we don't really have any pure evidence of that. You know, it's quite possible. This is the thing, this is why traditions and oral traditions and stuff like that do come into play, and it's perfectly normal in the Near East to have such a thing. Mm-hmm. I think people sometimes confuse a lot, and I've seen this happen with comments by people, for example, in Hebrew and Israel, where they, for example, go out at war against oral law, and they don't really know what it is. Mm. They don't really understand what it is. And oral law is not tradition, okay? Because if we say, for example, let's quote the words of Jesus. You know, he says, the tradition of men. Mm-hmm. Okay, what he means by that, it's not the word tradition separated from the word men. He's saying tradition and men, basically man-made things. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if we have a tradition of interpretation which doesn't contradict the text. For example, if I have, as a Jew, I have a tradition that we cite the new moon and this is how we calculate the calendar and we add a month every month and everything like that. Okay, that's my tradition. It has nothing to do with the tradition of men. It has to do with an interpretation tradition that was passed down this, throughout the centuries and is strongly based on text. And there'll be obviously be someone yelling out that it's not strongly based on text. Yeah, but the other opinions are based in the same system. You know, your arguments are like this, and you take all the different arguments and you look at them, and you suddenly realize that everyone's using either the same verses or they're using partial information. There's no 100% evidence inside the text for any opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this tradition, and then someone 50 years ago or 20 years ago, whatever it might be, came up with a new interpretation. So again, I can say that's your interpretation. I have an interpretation plus a tradition. Mm-hmm. So again, we can argue into a blue in the face. The main point is, and as like you said, we have to find valid arguments. And I think one of the things that really gets to me a lot is when people argue and they're just arguing, their point is to argue, and they have their opinion, mm-hmm. and they have the audacity sometimes not to even listen to other people because they have their opinion. I'm calling audacity deliberately because it's no longer an issue of are we having a scholarly discussion? It's just, I have my opinion, I'm going to put it in your face, and I don't care anymore. Yeah. And we can have a vote for that. It's called chutzpah.
You have
the chutzpah to do that. And I think that people have to really put their pride on the shelf. And I've had discussions with people about this, and I've sat down with different people with different opinions, and we're able to discuss these things without trying to throw blows at one another. You have to realize we are living in a reality where we don't have any real prophecy, if at all. We don't have the original authorities. We're exiled from the land, and things get forgotten. We certain traditions survived. And again, if one day we have no doubt proof that we have to look for the waning moon. So we do that. It's not the issue of being stubborn in your opinion. It's the issue of trying to find truth. And that's really the problem. Now, also, how do you define the concept of truth? That's another discussion
again. But what you're saying, though, is that I might present an argument based on the text and a number of passages. You might have an argument that's just as plausible based on the text and number of passages. But your argument may be backed up with the weight of centuries of tradition, and that can't be discarded. That's merely your point, right?
Yeah, and we also have to take the basic assumption: I'm always right, and you're always wrong.
I mean, we got to start with that, of course. But of course, I have to mention, because everybody listening to that will be going, well, hang on, what about Leviticus 23 verse 15? And it says, "And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Shabbat, after the Sabbath. From that day you brought a sheep, the wave offering, seven Sabbaths shall be complete." And so this is the counting of the Omer to Shavuot. Which Sabbath? And there is a tradition. There is a tradition which Sabbath is being spoken of, and where the counting begins and how that happens. But is that tradition correct?
Well, again, so you have that tradition, and I actually do know how they came to that conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But the main point is that here, for example, the text is very, very clear, because the word Shabbat is never, ever, ever, ever used anywhere in the Bible to mean a feast day. So again, when I have this discussion, for example, with people who are a lot more Orthodox than I am, they continue insisting the word Shabbat can also mean a feast day. But here specifically, it's not only that it's a discussion about one verse, then you carry on down the text and you discover that another place it uses the word Ad Mimachorat HaShabbat HaShavit, and until after the seventh Sabbath.
Mm.
Now, where do we have a feast day there? So here, the text itself allows us to interpret what it actually means. So, and also, by the way, another thing is that when you look at the Second Temple period, we know that there were disputes about this one left, right, and center.
Mm-hmm.
Calendar issues are a big, big, big thing.
They're huge.
Always been a big thing in all the cultures. The issue of sacred time is a big issue. And for example, like when I did with Keith Johnson the Time Will Tell series, I mentioned the whole thing of Jeroboam moving the feast, making a feast in Bet El as the feast in Jerusalem on the eighth month. Why is he moving to the eighth month? He's changing the calendar. Calendars, sacred time calendars, were a big, big thing. And whoever controlled the sacred time was the one who controlled the temple as well, mm-hmm. and controlled the life cycle of most of the people, yeah. including, for example, discussions about when do you bring certain types of tithe? When are the feast days? Mm-hmm. You know, you have power over economy. So, for example, a question that comes up a lot regarding the issue of a new moon is, are there any special things that you do on a new moon?
Yes.
And it seems as if in the first temple period, and maybe even partially in the second temple period, and even the Jerusalem Talmud mentions that the Jews of Jerusalem and the area used to do either a partial day of work where they work half a day and then the rest of the day they're at home, or even sometimes to some degree, for example, we have the verse in Amos,
Amos chapter 5, 8, verse 5, yeah.
8, verse 5, that it says, you know, Matai Avol Chodesh Veshabbat, Nashbir Abar, you know, when is the Sabbath and the new moon going to pass? And, you know, comparing the Sabbath to a new moon,
let me just read it, because what it says, at least in my New King James, it says, when will the new moon be passed that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath that we may trade wheat? And it seems to be suggesting, at least in that translation, that the new moon is also a day of rest. And it's interesting that you should bring that up, because in my study notes, Yoel, interestingly, under the passage that we just read of 1 Samuel chapter 20 from 3 till 8, in the study notes I've got, it says
some people say new moon, some people say it means the seventh year, the Shemitah year.
Well, I'm going to get to that. So it says the new moon was observed as a religious festival. It goes on to say it was customarily celebrated with a sacrificial meal and rest from work. And I thought, hang on, I don't remember any such stipulation. But, of course, it references Amos 8:5.
So we know that this was some kind of a custom, but there's no commandment. There's nothing in the Torah. And unless you say that the new moon is a Sabbath, like lunar Sabbath people would say, it can be one of two things: that it's either a lunar Sabbath, or that they had a custom to observe this as a holy day of sorts.
Mm.
The thing is that there are plenty of verses around the Bible that separate Shabbat from a feast day, including here.
Well,
if Shabbat was a new moon, then there would be no need to mention the word Chodesh, new moon.
Sure. Now, so, listen, you come in out of the wind. I don't know why, but you're suddenly in a windy place. I can hear it in the microphone.
This is a desert, and the wind. If I can have a window open, and there'll be nothing, and then there's a slight air pressure change, and suddenly there's this powerful wind coming out.
So anyway, the one last thing before we move on, just going back to Leviticus 23. Yom Teruah. Is it possible that it's Yom Teruah? Because is it not a day of rest? It's the first day of the month.
It's a day of rest. It's a feast day. Yom Teruah is a feast
day.
It's actually on the new moon.
It's on the new moon. But is
and
it?
Your
is
point
it,
is.
So potentially, can we be talking about Yom Teruah here?
I doubt it.
Okay.
Because they have zevach hayamim sham lechol hamishpacha. They have a sacrifice that they do. It's a yearly sacrifice that they do. Now, some people say that this is maybe related to the issue of what, for example, Elkanah also did. And there's this tradition. They say that Elkanah went to Shiloh also in Yom Teruah. As an addition to the three feasts that you have to go up to the temple, so maybe Yom Teruah, you never know.
I don't know. The only reason why I throw that into the mix is because David's saying he wants to go to Bethlehem, where there's once a year they sacrifice there for the family. Now, where do we think the tabernacle is at the moment?
At the moment, some people say it's probably in Nov or something like that, or in Givon. There's a different opinions where it was at.
Okay.
The tradition is that it was in Nov or something like that, okay. And this is why when David goes to meet Avimelech, they have the bread of the showbread,
mm-hmm.
Which means they had at least part of the tabernacles there, so it's possible.
Mm. At least some sort of observance at the very least. So verse 9, Jonathan said, "Far be it from you, for if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you?" And then David said to Jonathan, "Well, who will tell me? Or what if your father answers you roughly?" And Jonathan said to David, "Well, come, let us go to the field. So both of them went out to the field. And then Jonathan said to David, and here we have invoking the name of God again, Yehovah, God of Israel, is witness. When I have sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there is not good towards David, and I do not send to you and tell you, may Yehovah do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I will report it to you and will send you away that you may go in safety. And Yehovah be with you as he has been with my father, and you shall not only show me kindness, the kindness of Yehovah, while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when Yehovah has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. And so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, let Yehovah require it at the hand of Jonathan's enemies. Now, is there a hint that he understands that David will be king?
Yeah, the fact that he does a covenant with the house of David, he realizes that there's a possibility here. Specifically, when you go to verse 15, it says, ולא יחריט, לא תחריט את חסדך מעם ביתי, עד עולם, ולא בחריט אדוני אויבי דוד. There's a whole issue here. So some commentators try to claim that this whole thing of cutting off the tachrit from the root of karat has to do with the issue of also killing the offsprings of a certain family. And they claim it was very common for a new ruler to kill all the members of the family of the previous royal family. Mm-hmm. And they're saying maybe he's hinting here to such a thing, but it's not really clear 100%. Also, I noticed you were stumbling a bit on the English. It seems that someone was translating directly from the Hebrew and what you were reading from. And the Hebrew here is a bit strange. There are places where he uses the word lo, where it should be the word lu for an oath. There's some issues here with how they actually use the Hebrew here. There's some strange stuff going on here.
There is some strange stuff. Maybe it does read in sort of a clumsy sort of way. It's difficult to, mm-hmm. to get that out, to read that aloud. But the other thing is that, and I think you just mentioned this, but he really asked David. He says, look, listen, don't cut off my descendants from the face of the earth. I mean, when you become king, and it seems to be that he understands. I mean, we see it in the book of Kings, Kings 15, 1 Kings 15 and 16 and 2 Kings chapter 10, that the killing of that a new king will kill off the offspring of his predecessor.
Yeah, so it was apparently very common in the ancient world, and this is probably one of the things he's concerned about, which kind of raises an interesting question. So how moral were they? I mean, how much did they actually, you know, were they really moral people, or were they really just more around the cult of the religion, and not really nice, not really good people to one another, like the Torah commands? And there was even someone who, when I posed a question on Hebrew in Israel, you know, why on earth did David and Michal have a trafim at home? Mm-hmm. And someone mentioned, they were quoting an apocrypha that mentions that King David never actually read the Torah. He never knew what the Torah says, but we have evidence in other places where he knew very well. For example, when he mentions the issue of where they come after he sleeps with Bathsheba, the prophet comes to him and he mentions about the sheep that was stolen. Mm-hmm. Says, "Oh, he'll pay four times." So obviously he knew the civil law as well, which is also mentioned in the Torah. Mm-hmm. So there's a question here: why? First of all, all these murders in the Book of Samuel. Book of Samuel is a very bloody book. Mm. You know, Where's the Ten Commandments? Not to murder, not to steal, all these things, not to commit adultery. What does this all go away? Why is this all so lost? And you know, some people said they didn't know, and some people say that, you know, the level of morality wasn't as high as today. You know, we slowly developed through a religious evolution that we became more and more sensitive to certain
ideas. I don't know about that. Do you know what I think? Maybe another possibility, and maybe I'd be interested to see what you think. Maybe their morality is not the morality of today, and that's not to say that it's different or that it's evolved, but maybe what was moral to them in their customs and society is just different. Is that possible?
That's what I was trying to lead to.
Okay.
That sometimes, you know, people stand up and say, you know, we can't, I've heard this happen. One of my brother-in-laws says this, you know, I don't like the Bible because it's so bloody and so violent and everything. And I said to him, yeah, you're saying that because you're living in a very Western mindset where morality is something a bit different. There was an accusation many years ago that the morality that took over the world today is a Christian morality.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, you turn the other cheek and stuff like that, which, you know, is argued against that this is not the morality of the Bible. The Bible does not like that idea, where if someone tries to hurt you, you are allowed to protect yourself and even kill them if you have to.
Mm.
And, you know, being violent, first of all, being violent was something which was very common in the ancient world, and even in Europe and Africa and wherever you went around the world. And slowly people became more sensitive to the idea of the human condition.
Mm.
But yes, true. They lived in a very different world with different concepts, with different ideas. And this is why sometimes when people judge the Bible, they're judging it through the eyes of what they understand.
That's right.
Instead of judging it the way it should be judged as a text that comes from a very specific culture.
So true.
And one of the rules when I started learning biblical studies, one of the rules that was brought up in one of the books I read was that we can never ever read the Bible in our eyes, in our mindset, because we're going to miss out a lot of what's actually being done there. If we try to judge the Bible in our standards, we will not understand. You can never march into a culture and assume you know everything. And this is, I think, one of the big mistakes, for example, the United States did with different countries, like, for example, Afghanistan and Iraq, where they came in with the American mentality, and they really have no idea how to deal with them.
Mm.
And to such a point where, for example, when I was in the U.S., I was watching the news, and they had this so-called expert who was trying to analyze the situation in the Middle East, and I'm standing there smiling, and my dad looks at me and says, "What?" And I said, "This guy has no idea what he's talking about. He doesn't understand the Middle East. He doesn't know anything." And this is the big mistake that the Europeans made with the Muslim immigrants. The United States has made with the Muslim immigrants. It's a completely different culture. They're not here to assimilate. They're very, very zealous of their culture.
And it's a very sobering and challenging thing to do, to go back to the text of the Tanakh, and particularly ancient Israel, and reevaluate what we consider to be moral behavior with what was considered to be moral behavior back then. And to try and realign yourself to something. And I'm not saying that we should now. I mean, really, you know, our culture and our way of life in the Western influence anyhow is very, very tame. We're tamed animals. We're domesticated animals in a sense. We're pets of the system. We're pets of the system. Back then, it wasn't so.
People were a lot more emotional. People, all things were governed by emotion.
Mm.
You know, you know, if someone offends you, literally the first thing you think of is, where can I cut the guy? You know, it's part of the mentality of the Near East. It wasn't Western. And even 100 years ago, I'm not convinced that people were like, you know, humanists and vegetarianism and animal rights. And this is all new stuff.
Mm.
Now, do I think there's something wrong with vegetarianism? I don't like being a vegetarian. I tried it. It made me very, very sick. But do I think it's a bad thing? No. But for example, from vegetarian to saying, okay, humanity is a cancer and should be eradicated, well, now you have eco-terrorists, people who are out there to kill humans because humans are harming nature. That's insanity.
Mm.
You know, do I think there's something wrong with animal rights? No, I think that, first of all, if we torment, you know, our food, we're actually hurting our food and making our food sick.
Mm.
You know, if I had the ability to go and buy organic meat, I would have done that years ago.
Sure.
But I just don't have the money for that. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that a lot of the ideas that we go by today, and even I, living here in the Middle East, being born in Israel, living in Israel, being an Israeli, there's still a lot of stuff that we got influence from. And this is why, for example, I can understand Japan when they locked themselves away from the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
You can understand what is it, North Korea and China and places that where they're kind of trying to, not necessarily China, but different places and Iran, where they're trying to lock themselves away from Western culture because they recognize this as being a negative influence mm-hmm. on on their culture. They will be, it will destroy who they are, because it's very popular to the masses, and it's something that people like, the ability to be free and do whatever you want and basically step on sometimes seriously step on family values. For example, they're having the Pride Month here in Israel, and we're making a lot of noise about this. It makes me sick to my stomach. Where people, you want to be free, and you're confusing your identity with your sexuality.
So something to consider, but you know, I think you're right. It's and as I said, it is a sobering and challenging thing to meditate on. But it goes on now. Jonathan caused David to vow, because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. And Jonathan said to David, tomorrow is the new moon, here it is again, and you'll be missed because your seat will be empty. And when you have stayed 3 days, go quickly and come down to the place where you hid the day of the deed, and remain by the stone Ezel. The stone Ezel?
Stone called Ha'azel.
Ha'azel.
So there's Evan Ha'azel. There's actually, Evan Ha'azel is actually mentioned. First of all, Evan Ha'azel, that's an abnormality in using definite article. But Evan Ha'azel is actually mentioned in other places as well. It's actually a known place. What's also interesting is it says here that he will hide there at on the day of the deed. Okay, what is the day of the deed? So some people actually say it's the day after the new moon, where it was a day where they're allowed to do work. What is the day of the deed? The day of the deed can also be the day of the oath. It's possible that they were doing, that he's referring to the day that they take, today when they're doing an oath, but it's very strange. So Yom HaMaaseh, some people refer it as Sheshet Yomim Ta'aseh Melachtecha Yom HaShavi'i. So Melachtecha can be also parallel to Asiyah, which is a day. But again, it's anyone's guess what this actually means.
Really? Okay, so now when that's interesting that you point that out, because when I read it, the day of the deed, I assumed was the day that he confronts his father and you know, figures out what is what he has in mind for David. But that's not necessarily the case, is what you're saying.
Yeah, the syntax here is a bit strange. Again, it's
interesting. Okay,
it says here, "Uvatayla makom asher nistarta sham beyom ha'maaseh." You're hiding somewhere the day of the deed. It's the whole thing is just weird.
So Jonathan goes on and says, "You know, I'll shoot 3 arrows on the side, to the side, as though I shot at a target." And
arrows being used as signs for things. We also have the story with Elisha and the king of Israel. He tells him to fire out arrows. You remember that? To fire an arrow through the window and then hit on the ground. Arrows, and also we have in Jeremiah where it mentions that Nebuchadnezzar was using arrows. He was sharpening arrows and using them for some kind of oracle or something. So arrows are used as symbols, though I don't think he's using it the same way here. But I think he's just using. But it's interesting that arrows do show up in the Near East, the ancient Near East, as being something that was used for an oracle.
That's a good point. I didn't think of that. And he said, "I'll shoot them, and I'll say to a lad, and I'll say, look, go and find the arrows, and I'll expressly say to the lad, look, the arrows are on this side of you. Get them and come. Then as Yehovah lives, there is safety for you and no harm. But if I say to the young man, look, the arrows are beyond you, go your way, for Yehovah has sent you away. And as for the matter which you and I have spoken of, indeed, Yehovah be between you and me forever." So he's got this signal by which, I suppose, if he's being watched, he doesn't have to necessarily interact with David. He can make it plain to David what the outcome of his confrontation with Saul is. And then David hid in the field, and when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. And now the king, you know, sat in his seat as at other times on the seat by the wall. Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Shaul's side, but David, his place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has happened to him. He's unclean. Surely he's unclean. Okay, let's stop there for a second.
So, first of all, the playing is like a musical chair there. That he's supposed to sit here, then he moves in, and basically Saul realizes there's something wrong with the seating. He recognizes someone's missing. And then Saul also says to him, he says to himself, "Lo diber Shaul me'uma bayomahu." Saul didn't say anything on that day. Ki amar mikrehu. Now the word mikre reminds us of the description. What is it in I'm trying to remember. Is it Numbers or is it Leviticus? I can't remember now. Yeah. Where he mentions a person who becomes unclean during the night.
Due to a
natural thing that can happen. Mm-hmm. And the word mikrehu reminds us of this. They may basically, he might have woken up in the morning and, he's not clean anymore. Mm. And he says, okay, so maybe something happened. Mikrehu lo tahohu. He can also say the word mikra means an incident. And something happened and he's unclean. He walked in the field, he touched something, he by mistake walked through a graveyard or something. It's possible. So we're specifically dealing here with not graveyard, because graveyard will make him unclean for 7 days. We're specifically dealing here with something that lasts 1 day, which can be an issue of things that last 1 day. You can just open up the book of Leviticus and see it yourself.
So you know, ritual, he might have sat, ritual impurity. Might, so what?
Yeah,
what
there's,
what
there's a long often, there's a long list of one there's a long list of 1 day things.
The first thing. Let's be blunt. The first thing off the list is usually an emission of semen, and which would render somebody unclean. Now one thing about that, and there's a list of things that could possibly be the case, but. What it does suggest is the timing, because one can become clean again at evening, and so one asks, are they meeting during the day for this festival, for this meal, or are they there in the evening?
No, it's obviously during the day.
It's obviously during the day, yeah.
And it's probably even first thing in the morning or very early during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Possible as well. It might be that it isn't. So obviously it was something that can happen first thing in the morning. This is in the morning. So it could be something that happened the previous day, because mm-hmm. if it was a one day thing, then he'll be able to clean himself by the sunset of the next day,
mm-hmm.
or the next sunset. So it's possible that this is something that he said, oh, maybe something happened first thing in the morning. It's a 1 day thing. And he's sitting there and he's waiting. Mm. The one thing it's an interesting question here is, why doesn't he say the same thing to himself the next day as well?
Well, it's interesting.
Maybe he did something which made him unclean for 7 days. Why is he?
Yeah. So it's interesting. So he says in 27, it happened that the next day, on the second day of the month, that David's place was empty, and Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to eat? Either yesterday or today, so Jonathan answered.
Yeah, I think you should stop here for a second, because the Hebrew says, "Ve'im acharat chodesh hashini," and the Hebrew itself it sounds as if it's saying that they celebrated the new moon 2 days, no, 1 day, mm-hmm. which is something that Rav Saadia Gaon specifically used, arguing, look, they were celebrating 2 days. Obviously, it's a 2 day thing, because in the rabbinic tradition, you celebrate. If it's 30 days of the previous month, the 30th day and the first day are both considered to be as if they're a new moon day, and that comes from the whole issue of maybe we miscalculated, maybe they sighted the moon this day or that day, so they plan. So the 30th day is really the first day, and the first day is the first day. And it's a kind of a thing that they developed when they were creating the pre-calculated calendar for the possibility of compensating for different things. But for example, we had 30 days for the previous month, for the month of Sivan. We already are in the second day. Today is the second day based on the rabbinic calendar. Today is the second day of the fourth month. But we're only going to be seeing the new moon here in Israel tonight, which means that on the third day of the fourth month based on the rabbinic calendar is the first day based on the moon sighting. So there's a 2 day difference. Hmm. And in any case, Rav Saadia Gaon was bothered by the fact that you go out, you see the new moon here, but we just celebrated 2 days ago. So he was trying to find every possible verse that might support his opinion, and the Hebrew here is corrupted. And when you read it in English, the English actually has it. The English wrote it. The English is actually probably what it really means. That on the second day of that month. Now, why are they having a second day? The possibility is that when they bought the sacrifice, it was a lot of meat. Maybe they bought a cow or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm,
or,
mm-hmm.
Not a cow, but an ox or a, sure. or something younger than that. And it was a lot of meat. Now, this is a shlamim. So shlamim are eaten for 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to burn it by the third. If you have anything left, you burn it on the third day.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sitting down to continue the meal. This is why This is why they had a second day. Also the possibility is, if we actually look at the verses here, is that today, this is the second day of the month, and they're not sitting down to eat a pure meal. Mm. So it's not something you have to be ritualistically pure. And there's no reason for David not to show up. So this is already something that Saul goes, okay, this is something wrong here. So even if David was unclean by contacting the dead or something that lasts for 7 days, there was no reason on earth for him not to show up on this one.
Mm. So Michal deceives Saul in the, was it chapter 18? I think she did that. But now it's Jonathan's turn. And he said to his father, David earnestly asked permission for him to go to Bethlehem. And he said, you know, please let me go. My family has a sacrifice in the city. My brothers have commanded me to be there. And now, if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore, he's not come to the king's table. Then Shaul's anger.
By the way, he uses the word emaleta na ve'eretechai. Emaleta is from the root of malat, which is to get away, to escape. And using that word might have actually told Saul the truth that he's actually running away. Uh-huh. He used that word. He had a slip of tongue, and he was planning to say, "No, let me." Emaleta means let me go in haste. That's what Jonathan means, but by using that double meaning, Saul goes like, you just used a word that gave away what you're doing. And right. What you're really doing is that he's running away, you're letting him escape, you're aiding the enemy.
Now this is, okay, and he loses it here, and he says a whole lot of stuff. Yoel, I mean, come on, you've got to explain this.
Oh,
this
man.
This is verse 30. His anger arose against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son, now this is what I've got in my New King James, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. I've got an exclamation mark after that. I do have woman in italics. We'll get to that in a minute. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? What?
Oh, he's completely losing it. He's just throwing out some of the nastiest curses you can say to someone.
What does that mean in
here? At least here in the Middle East, it's some of the nastiest things you can say to a person.
Really?
What he's telling him is that he is a son of, corrupted corrupted education, because mardut can mean mered, which is rebellious, but also na'avat is from the root of avar, ivut, which is corruption, and mardut can also be another word for education, which may be rare, if even real, but some people say it means education. So he says you have a corruption of education, and
really?
Not
let,
woman,
let me just ask
education.
You about that. Let me just ask you about that, because I have in italics, which obviously isn't in the text, they've put in woman, a perverse and rebellious woman, exclamation mark. Why would they think to put that there?
Because some interpretations mean that the mardut has to do with his mother. Some people say it might be that he is like a rebellious slave girl or something. Basically very demeaning towards women. Let's be very blunt.
Yeah.
And so part of the issue here is claiming that he is as bad as a rebellious girl servant who doesn't know better, mm-hmm. or that he has a corrupted education, which, by the way, would indicate why he talks about his mother. That you know, he got his education from his mother. His mother might have been a very, very rebellious woman as well, and that might explain the whole family thing. Why the families, everyone's turning against him. His son, his daughters. But I think that the worst thing here is that he turns around. You choose the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness.
Hmm.
And standing in front of an entire crowd of people saying your mother's nakedness is pretty harsh. And there's even an Arab there's a cuss word in Arabic that refers to one's mother's nakedness. And remember when I read this, is he saying this and this to him? And a friend of mine looked at me and said, yeah. And I even remember there was a rabbi I met, and he's a pretty interesting character, this rabbi. Mm-hmm. He's not mainstream. He's very interesting. And he basically said, look, you know, when someone gets really, really angry, he can use a cuss word, you know, nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. You know, in a lot of cultures, some people say, oh, it's very bad to use cuss words, very bad to use bad language. And I agree with that. I avoid using bad language as much as I can, though I know how to cuss in about 4 or 5 different languages. Mm. But you know, the first words you always learn is the cuss words. But the question is, for example, if you by mistake say something which is a cuss word, by mistake, you know, you hit your foot, and you throw out some saucy word out there, is it a sin? Some people really regard it as being a sin. The answer is probably not. The Torah doesn't tell you you can't use cuss words, but using cuss words, if you go to Proverbs, it's just a lack of morality. A person who doesn't know how to keep his tongue, or a person who, although keeping tongue in the book of Proverbs really has to do with gossip, but you know, someone who utters out a cuss word because he just banged his foot or something or hurt himself, that's normal. Mm. It's a way of releasing tension and the anger of what just happened. I personally try not to, but
it's frowned upon, but it's not specifically in black and white according to the Torah. It's not a sin, but in any case, Saul really does let rip here, but it goes
he completely loses it
for as long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, you shall not be established, he's saying to Jonathan, nor your kingdom. Now, he already knows this, of course, but he's seeing what he can do about it. Now, therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. So there it is, and there's no two ways about it. Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? Now, he's said this to him before, but here Jonathan's quite angry, and he says, why should he be killed? What has he done? Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. You know, it's funny. It reads like in the English, you know what? You know, when you threw that spear at me, I'm kind of thinking. Now, obviously, it was pretty straightforward, and he got out of there pretty quick.
Yeah, but I don't think Vayeda Yehonatan Kichalai Mim Aviv. I don't think that the spear throwing was the fight. I think the spear throwing was the climax of the drama. But I think that the entire discussion was what really gave him the closure. Really,
I think so.
But when you read it without correct punctuation, it looks as if the spear throwing is what really. Okay, now I get it. I don't think that was it.
Sort of rubbing his chin going, I think that means. And so anyway, so Jonathan arose from the table.
Be a bit more comic. So he throws a spear. He looks at it and says, okay, I take from this that you don't like David. really, this is why punctuation is very, very important sometimes. Right.
So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month. And there again, that sort of lends again to the timing of the incident. Because it seems, according to that text, that for the rest of the day he ate nothing.
Yeah, that's possible. Also, I think that the whole usage here of the second day of the month, they're basically trying to say it's in sequence. They met up. There was the first day. There was the second day. He walks away. Now they're going to meet up on the third day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there you go. So good point. So he was grieved with David because his father had treated him shamefully. And so it was in the morning. So here we are. We're in the third day that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David. And a little lad was with him, and he said to the lad, now run and find the arrows which I shoot. And as the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him, and the lad had come to the place where the arrow was, which Jonathan had shot. And Jonathan cried.
Your English says to beyond him. The Hebrew actually says to cause him to go beyond, make him go forward.
Make him go further so that he could call out to him with a loud voice. So he cried out to the lad, and he said, is not the arrow beyond you? And Jonathan cried out after the lad, make haste, hurry, do not delay. And so that, I mean, I suppose that's what he's really crying out to David, saying, it's time for you to flee. You really got to go and don't stop.
Yeah.
And he says, Jonathan, the lad gathered up all the arrows and he came back to his master. But the lad did not know anything. Only Jonathan and David knew of the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the lad and said to him, go, carry them to the city. And so off he goes. And obviously, you know, David couldn't get it. He didn't want to just leave like that. Jonathan obviously didn't want him just to leave like that. They've obviously sent the lad away, and they're going to meet up. As soon as the lad had gone, David rose from the place towards the south, fell on his face to the ground and bowed down three times. They kissed one another and they wept together, but David more so. Three times. What's that about?
Three times again, 3, 7. You know, it's a quite common thing. You don't do once; you do three times. It's the way they treated the issue of how many times you do something. Okay. You know, why does the king of Israel bang three times on the floor with the arrows? You know, it's three times. It looks like a reasonable thing. You know, for example, people have a obsessive behavior; they have to do something three times before they walk out. Sure. It's a symbol. The three is a symbolic. It's more than one. It's more than two. Three is a lot.
Okay, but bowing three times is he's paying honor to Jonathan, or what is this gesture? What does it mean?
Bowing down to the floor is a sign of respect. Of humbling oneself before someone. Mm-hmm. But also, by the way, just to mention this, there's a whole discussion about the way numbers were understood in the ancient world. And one of the theories they came up with was that 1 and 2 was easy to count. 3 was already considered to be a lot.
Mm.
There's just this number theory thing that goes on that really they only counted 1 and 2, and anything above 2 was considered to be more than anything else they've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
But that's maybe theoretical for an earlier stage in counting and everything. But maybe it's archaic. Maybe it's like a frozen, it's a fossilized custom of doing 3 or 7.
Mm, sure.
Both of these numbers are symbolic in the ancient world.
And the final verses, Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of Yehovah, saying, 'May Yehovah be between you and me, between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" So he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So they're just reaffirming the covenant that they've made between each other in the name of Yehovah, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm. So we can call this a chapter of oath-taking.
It is. There's so much of it. It's
there's a lot of oath-taking going on in this chapter. They're very busy promising things to one another.
Mm.
Because really they're about to departure from one another, and probably they're never going to see one another again. And they understood this. This is where David really starts standing for his own. And he goes around and becomes more and more taking care of himself.
Mm. Hmm. And that just occurred to me. I was just wondering before you said that, I wonder if they actually get to see each other again. They may see each other on the field, perhaps, who knows, but I'm just struggling to think of a time when they interact with each other again after this moment.
No, I don't, because in a couple of chapters, Jonathan dies together with his father.
Yeah.
But this is where David starts wandering, making a name for himself, becoming a leader of a group of people. You know, his beginning as a leader is kind of iffy because he takes with him a lot of the people who are people who live really on the outskirts of society, mm-hmm. the ones that have debts and everything, and he's running around. And one of the major problems that goes on here as well is the fact that anyone he meets up with, Saul goes and kills, which is really what's going to happen in the next chapter.
Mm.
And this educates David with the issue of you know, interior warfare. And interior fights with his own people, which is really one of the main themes about David. He really, he went through hell with a lot of people throughout his life.
Absolutely. So chapter 21, as you mentioned, there's a lot of deaths here, and this is not a chapter without controversy either. But there it is, 1 Samuel chapter 20, Yoel ben Shlomo. Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page. A reminder to everybody, Hebrew in Israel is the Facebook page where you will find Yoel. Go there, like the page, and interact with the information there. Until next time, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.
Shalom. Kotuf.